We're expecting a large number of folks to join us from around the country tonight. Healthcare Now has called an emergency conference call to discuss the threats to Medicare and Medicaid in particular, as presented in the 2012 budget that the Republicans put forward last week. And people on the line know Healthcare Now as the national grassroots campaign supporting single-payer healthcare. We have members and supporters in every state across the country. We work very closely with Physicians for a National Health Program and the California Nurses Association, who are also partnering and sponsoring this call. People who are listening in are muted, but you can email questions during the call to me at katie@healthcare-now.org. So tonight we are really excited to talk with Deanne McEwen, Dr. Alvin Carrasquillo, and Dr. Margaret Flowers about the threats to Medicare and Medicaid as they're put forward in Congress at this time. Just a few brief introductions so folks on the line know who we're talking with. Deanne McEwen is an ICU nurse at Long Beach Medical Center. She's the co-president of the California Nurses Association. And Dr. Alvin Carrasquillo is co-founder of Latinos for National Health Insurance. He is a Puerto Rican-born physician raised in the Bronx. He was recently appointed as the Chief of Division of General Internal Medicine at the University of Miami School of Medicine. Before that, he was in the faculty at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons. And his areas of research include minority health, health disparities, health insurance, and access to care. And Dr. Flowers, who will be joining us shortly, is a Maryland pediatrician with experience as a hospitalist at a rural hospital and in private practice. In addition to her activity as co-chair of the Maryland chapter for Physicians for a National Health Program, she is the congressional fellow for PNHP. She's also on the board of Healthcare Now, as well as Dr. Carrasquillo, and on the steering committee of the Leadership Conference for Guaranteed Healthcare. So we have a great lineup to discuss the current political moment we're in right now. And I think that if it works, I know that we have on the line Dr. Carrasquillo as well as Deanne McEwen. And if it's all right with folks, we'll go ahead and start with Deanne, who's with us from California, and then hear from Dr. Carrasquillo, and Dr. Flowers will be joining us. Then we'll be able to open up to Q&A facilitated by myself. So we are really looking forward to hearing from our panel tonight. Deanne, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, you sound great. Thanks so much for joining the call.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I just don't know where to begin. In terms of saving Social Security and Medicare, those to us as nurses, those are public health programs. Since it was established, Social Security's paid out every nickel it's been, it was owed to every eligible American in good times and as bad. And despite its success, it's been facing an unprecedented attack from Wall Street, the Republican Party, and a few Democrats. And that's where politics becomes real personal for us nurses, because it's putting people at risk of harm. It hurts patients. This is a matter of life and death that we preserve and expand and improve these programs, especially Medicare, which is the only form of single-payer health insurance that we have in this country, and people depend on it. So trying to privatize that and turning public money or giving people vouchers to give to the private insurance industry where they can profit at the expense of our patients is just wrong.
And Deanne, do you want to speak to the proposal that is being presented by the Republicans on the voucherization of Medicare and the block grant proposal of Medicaid?
Well, I think, you know, really that's in terms of the voucher program, again, as I said, and I'm hoping my reception is okay, I'm on my cell phone, that to dismantle this social safety net program is unconscionable to me. Vouchers would be giving money. It would put it back in the hands of an insurance industry that's responsible for the problem. It's like giving the keys to the person that wrecked your car back to them. With the current recession still widespread, many private employers have reduced their pension benefits, and Social Security remains critically important, as Medicare is, and I think it would be a disaster to cut it now. Really, privatization is not the way we go. Social Security and Medicare shouldn't be the scapegoats for high deficits, and the best way to cut deficits is to end expensive corporate tax loopholes and end the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and now Libya, and not penalize working people. And the promise that was made to them through the New Deal programs to provide for them when they're sick, when they're infirm, when they're disabled, and when they're old. Morally, it's a matter of how we spend our money that shows really where our moral compass is in this country.
Very well said, Dan. Thank you so much. And with that, let's move the dialogue to Dr. Carrasquillo. Dr. Carrasquillo, it would be excellent to hear your thoughts on the proposals for the privatization of Medicare and the plan for Medicaid to move to block grants and the other attacks on social insurance, and your thoughts on this political moment as well as the impact on health disparities in this country.
Yeah, and I think Margaret will expand a little bit on Medicare. But, you know, the main concern with Medicare is that we're really concerned about total health care costs here. I mean, it's clear, you know, this what they call premium support. They don't want to use the word voucher because they give the money directly to the insurance company and bypassing the people altogether. It's going to drive up health care costs, and we know that's what's going to happen. It will reduce government costs by shifting a lot more of that to the individual person. But overall, it's not limited at all to limit health care spending. It's to make people pay much more out of their own pocket for the health care. So it's basically a way to – I think one of the things that frustrates a lot of people about Medicare is that it's extremely equitable. It's the most form of equitable insurance. And this puts it back in the form that it will be basically rationed based on ability to pay, and it's going to be a race to the bottom with these insurance plans. So Medicare is extremely concerning, what's happening with this to throw everybody. Right now at UM, just because the plans are getting so much harder, and it was the same when I was up at Columbia, the amount of managed care plans we take here is extremely limited. Right now we only take one, whereas the fee-for-service Medicare is what we really, it's the only one we could really, you know, do well by our patients. So it's extremely problematic what's happening to Medicare. But, I mean, the one I really most concerned about is basically this whole thing about giving states a lump sum that they could do with for Medicaid. And that's really scary. Here in Florida, for those of you that are not from the state, our governor is basically proposing to end the – well, not really end the Medicaid program, but basically convert everybody on Medicaid into private HMO plan. Our experiments with HMO Medicaid here were pretty disastrous in terms of access, quality of the care, and the cost savings. While it basically everyone agrees no one ever did a cost savings, the best we can agree on is that while it may have cost us a lot of money, certainly saved us no money, and based on data showing that quality access worsened and it didn't save us any dollars, the move has been to put everybody in a Medicaid HMO because, quote-unquote, the best way is to get the government out of the healthcare delivery business. So it's really an assault up. I think with very conservative leadership in a lot of states, it's going to be really scary what would happen by turning Medicaid into a lump sum program, especially for safety net institutions, that those that really depend on this. We do know that a lot of these plans want to keep their patients out of the safety net institutions and sort of divert them to sort of low-quality community-type providers, but not send them to the traditional safety net providers. So it is scary what will happen, I think, with the Medicaid block program. Katie, were there what was the other part you wanted me to address? I lost my
excellent. And anything you want to say with the focus on health disparities in this country, the way the the proposals will impact the landscape of our healthcare system.
I mean, it's just, I mean, from a whole health disparity, I mean, we want equity. I mean, ideally, in an ideal world, what I would want is everyone to have one insurance, Medicare for all, so everyone has equal access. The more you start converting Medicare into rationing by ability to pay, and the more you turn Medicaid into basically, you know, have private, the cheapest plans deliver the care, I obviously going to widen disparities and really set us back a big point. When every disparity article says, before we start talking about eliminating disparities, let's make sure everyone has equitable access, and then we could deal with the other stuff. So it's obviously moving us back. I mean, I don't know what else to say about it.
Yeah, if I may, I'd like to just add, Medicare really is the heart of the American medical system. What we have, it's the only part of our system that works best. It has the lowest overhead at only 3%. It cares for many of our most vulnerable patients, and nearly 100 million Americans are cared for by Medicare, Medicaid, or the Children's Health Insurance Program. 100 million people already, that's one in three. Almost all of our elders and the poorest among us and the disabled. And so there's just simply no replacements available for these programs. So carving them up and removing that social safety net certainly is going to cause harm. And it's simply heartless. And, you know, our community values, caring and compassion, our spending ought to reflect that. And so we need to expand and improve it. Again, as Dr. Mentioned, it's just socially unjust that you only get care based on whether or not you can pay for it. I mean, as a nurse, all of us every day that are primary providers here, I work in an ICU. My patient's 53 years old. She's had a horrible subarachnoid hemorrhage. She's comatose. She will not survive. 53. She has high blood pressure. She's a legal immigrant here with her husband 11 years ago from Korea. They're hardworking people. Husband worked at a job where no health insurance at all was provided. They quite simply could not afford the over $200 a month for the blood pressure medications that was prescribed to her. Now here she is dying with two young children. One just graduated from college. The other's in school to become a minister of the gospel. And these people are now leaving brokenhearted and the victims of a broken system. And, you know, just every day we see patients like this, and they're put now in further jeopardy. They're trying to qualify her for Medicaid so that the hospital will get some reimbursement. But, again, it's just inhumane, this system that we have now. It's actually a healthcare industry. We don't really have a healthcare system in this country. The best advice we can give someone is don't get sick, but we know that's not reasonable, and we need to provide for people in the most effective way that we know. And Senator Harry Reid has said, you know, that Medicare is the best insurance program we have for covering sick people. We need to expand it and improve it, and I believe we can do that.
Anne, thank you so much, and it's so important to hear the voices of health professionals that are leading this charge for improved Medicare for all. We're so lucky to have you advocating for patients on the ground as well. And we're going to move to our third speaker tonight. Dr. Margaret Flowers is on the line. She's been working with Physicians for a National Health Program on this issue specifically for the past several months, and it's going to give a landscape of where we've been and these developments coming out of the Deficit Commission and recommendations on what we need to do as advocates in fighting back. Margaret, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Katie.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, hopefully I won't cover anything that's been said already, but I wanted to give a little bit of a background on the Deficit Commission, which is known as the Fiscal The National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform, which was created in April of 2010 by President Obama. It was 18 people appointed to a bipartisan commission. 14 of them were known as deficit hawks, and it included Representative Paul Ryan, who is now the chair of the Budget Committee in the House. During the summer of 2010, many of you may have been aware of the America Speaks town halls, which were sponsored by the private foundation Pete Peterson, which is a group which has been dedicated to ending what they call our entitlement programs, but we call them social insurance programs. These are Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Many of our single-payer supporters attended those town hall events, and what was interesting is that despite the fact that the literature that was provided downplayed single-payer and tried to steer people in the direction of cutting our social insurances, during the day, the host in the Philadelphia town hall, that which was the main one, had to come on and say, we're getting a lot of complaints that there isn't a single-payer option, and you can write that in if that's what you support. So despite their efforts, the audience spoke loudly and clearly for single-payer. When it came down to the wire, the commission was supposed to pass recommendations by December 1st, which would go to Congress to help them shape the budget. They were unable to vote by December 1st, but they still came out with a booklet of recommendations, which was called Our Moment of Truth. And it was generally understood that these recommendations would be used by Congress, put into the budget recommendations that they would make going into our 2012 budget. So Representative Paul Ryan said that he was going to incorporate these. And what the report had said when it came to healthcare, what the Moment of Truth said, was that if the federal legislation, the ACA, failed to meet certain goals, then that would trigger changes to things like Medicare and Medicaid. Unfortunately, Representative Paul Ryan is not even going for the triggers. He's just going straight to trying to change our Medicare and Medicaid. So he came out with a budget proposal recently called the Path to Prosperity. And what he's pushing on Medicare, you may have heard already that it's changing to a Medicare voucher program, which instead of having a defined benefit or saying that these are the services that we will cover, it's a defined premium, meaning this, we will give you this much money to go out into the market and purchase private insurance. In addition, the age of eligibility for Medicare is set to increase to 67 by the year 2033. So what are our concerns about going to Medicare vouchers? Well, first off, the subsidies that Medicare enrollees are going to be given to purchase private insurance are not meant to keep up with medical inflation. And so over time, more and more of the cost of paying for this private insurance is going to be put on the seniors or those who qualify for Medicare, which pushes them in the direction of either spending more out of pocket or buying skimpier policies. Half of our Medicare population has an income of around $20,000 a year, and they're already spending about $4,000 to $5,000 per year on health care. So there's really no wiggle room there for seniors to be able to put more money out of pocket for their health care. We're also going to be having higher health care costs because pushing seniors into private insurance means that we're now having to pay for the administrative waste of private insurers. It's also further fragmenting our health care financing so that we have less and less ability to negotiate and control our health care costs. We also are concerned that there will be poorer health outcomes, as we know that putting more of the cost of health care onto patients means that they delay and forego necessary care. The most recent RAND study that looked at this showed that patients across income levels, if they have to pay out of pocket, will delay or avoid care, and that they're unable to discriminate between necessary and unnecessary care. Another concern is that we don't have experience with seniors purchasing private insurance on the individual market, because for the last 46 years almost, we've had Medicare for our seniors. So it's questionable what the premiums will be and what the coverage will be for seniors trying to purchase insurance on the open market. Now, when it comes to Medicaid, the block grants mean, again, instead of defining the population that would receive Medicaid, such as a certain income level, states will be given a certain amount of money to allocate as best they can. And they're talking about cutting $800 billion from Medicaid over a 10-year period. The concern is that during a time of recession, we have more people who need Medicaid, and that's what we're experiencing right now. So cutting back on the amount of money that we're spending means that fewer people will be covered and less benefits will be covered. This means that people will not be able to get needed services, and this is going to increase our suffering and the death of patients on Medicaid. So another concern that we need to have, something that's going through Congress right now, is called Senate Joint Resolution 10. And this was also put forth by Representative Ryan. And what he's asking to do is to cap federal spending, except for war. They exclude war, anything that has to do with the military. And so they want to cut it to 18% of our GDP. And that means, again, in times of economic recession, when we actually need to be investing in social insurances, unemployment, food stamps, we're going to have less money to invest in these things, and that will hurt us and make it more difficult to recover. But another part of Senate Joint Resolution 10 is Section 4, which states that any legislation which requires a new tax or an increase in tax is going to require a two-thirds majority to pass. And so for those of us who advocate for single payer, which would qualify for raising or creating a new tax, means that it raises the bar and makes it more difficult for us to pass a single payer plan through Congress. We're in a time where the narrative that's going around is that we have a serious deficit problem, and as a result, we have to start implementing austerity measures. We're seeing this on both sides of the aisle, giving this narrative forth, and it's the wrong narrative because we actually do have greater wealth in this country than we've had previously. It's just that the wealth is concentrated at the top, and the top is not being taxed anywhere near the rates that they were taxed previously a few decades ago. And so we're seeing a tax on our health care, on our social insurances, and this is absolutely the time, because of these attacks, to be pushing forward on Medicare for All, to be making our argument to defend these public programs. It keeps healthcare in the spotlight right now, and we know that Medicare for All would address both our healthcare problems and our deficit problems. And so I think that we should be coming out very strongly right now to defend them, to be visible, to give these arguments. And if you go to the PNHP website, there's two pieces that I wrote that you may find helpful. One is my testimony to the Deficit Commission last year, and the other is a summary from a congressional briefing that we held in September of last year with Dr. Sunmei Cheng from Princeton, and that outlines talking points about the consequences of these changes to Medicare. So I'll conclude with that, and I look forward to our discussion.
This is Katie, and I'm moderating the call tonight. And for the listeners out there, if you have questions, you can email them in to me at Katie, K-A-T-I-E, at healthcare-now.org. And we're going to do our best to get through these questions. And I want to thank our excellent panel this evening. I think this has given a well-rounded perspective on what's coming out from Congress, and also the impact it will have on our patients and on our lives. But just to start with the dialogue with people who are emailing in, Margaret, you may be able to answer this, and Deanne and Dr. Cardeschio, please feel free to weigh in. One concern is, well, what is the timeline that we're dealing with in terms of the voting on any of these changes to Medicare and Medicaid? I know that we're just barely keeping the budget going for 2011, and the budget proposal that is most egregious in terms of attacking Medicare and Medicaid is for 2012, for next year. So what kind of timeline are we dealing with? Do you have a sense of?
Yes. Well, the 2012 budget begins on October 1st of this year. So they're going to have to come up with a budget before October 1st. I think the next big date for a vote is coming up in mid-May. And what we're waiting for right now is Representative Ryan has put forth his proposal, the Path to Prosperity, but apparently President Obama is going to be countering with a different proposal. And he has indicated that in that proposal he is going to cut Medicaid and Medicare. So we haven't seen that yet. But I think that we should act with urgency. We should start contacting our members of Congress right away and getting this information out into the community right away that, one, we need to defend these programs, but also that these austerity measures are completely unnecessary. And there was an excellent article by Joseph Stiglitz, especially in Vanity Fair this month, which outlines why these austerity measures are not necessary.
Great. Thanks so much. There's also been some general questions to step back and sort of look at the entire crisis as it is, you know, even before we've been hearing about these new proposals attacking social insurance programs. But I'm wondering if the panel can address, first of all, why are healthcare costs so high in this country? And what parts of Medicare, in terms of the program that is so successful, can we talk a little bit about the parts of Medicare that are successful and also those parts that are privatized based on the 2003 law with Medicare Part D and Medicare Advantage plans? Can we sort of talk about total healthcare costs and the privatization of Medicare as it is, which is really impacting the successfulness of the program? And I open that to the panel to respond to.
Well, we have a problem. This is Deanne speaking again, because we do have a for-profit system. We've got over 30% of each dollar spent in healthcare as administrative waste, executive bonuses, money that should be put into healthcare. I mean, we already know single payer was never included, and that's the only program that's going to help us control costs. We can have group purchasing power. And we can improve outcomes. And the reason that Medicare is successful is that you have it. You're not denied access to health care based on your ability to pay. You can go to any provider. You can seek early treatment. You can have follow-up care. What's happened with it is that as the prescription drug coverage has been privatized and parceled out to the pharmaceutical companies, then seniors are being left with handed prescriptions for medications they can't afford, and so they go without. So that puts them at further risk of decline. And I will have to be leaving the call here shortly to go back to work at work today, but I wanted to thank you for putting this together, the opportunity to speak. I did look at the website. One of the questions that came up that I wanted to address, though, specifically was the Social Security. Someone wanted to know about Social Security and adding that it was burying our children with mountains of debt. And I really don't think that as a mother and a grandmother and any of us would want to burden anyone's children with debt. Social Security hasn't added a single cent to the federal budget deficit. People are not aware of that. The government does not fund Social Security. American workers do. It's funded directly by payroll contributions divided equally between workers and their employers. And so it's fully financed for years to come. Our youth are falling behind our generation, and due to the decline in quality, because we've given over health care to the control of these private insurers, and it's out of the hands of direct care providers like myself and Dr. Flowers. And our decisions are always second-guessed by bean counters, and people are pushed out of the system and denied access because they don't have an ability to pay. As far as the fiscal commission, the deficit commission, saying everything is on the table, so far everything has not been on the commission table of consideration. Many potential sources of revenue have been conveniently absent and overlooked. What about a financial transaction tax against Wall Street? Where's the discussion about closing tax loopholes and other tax advantages for wealthy corporations and individuals? And again, the war. Robert Greenwald on his site
you can go on there and plug in your income and look at how much of your taxes. I mean, 25 to 30% of our taxes go to fund these wars, and I would rather they fund health care. You know, so I think that this is our opportunity and our moment to, in terms of civil disobedience, if you will, we've got to hold politicians accountable and really go to their offices and really show them to be the demons and the inhumane enemies of the people that they are, because they're harming people, they're killing people, and they're really doing it when they've got full coverage that we provide as taxpayers, and instead of Social Security, or you know, they're taking it away, carving it up for the special interest, and we just can't stand for that.
Thank you so much, Deanne. And we know you have to return to work, and we thank you for joining us tonight and all you do for this work and this movement. And I want to offer the opportunity for others to respond as well to the question of health costs and the privatization of Medicare.
Yeah. I mean, I just want people to understand, because, one, it's, the Part D plans that came out as opposed to, based on the prior laws where we're right now paying Medicare plans more to provide the same services as Medicare. And obviously part of the money for the new health reform law was from trying to limit those overpayments to the private plans. So in essence, we're paying them a lot more to do the same. With the new proposals, it's something very different in terms of privatizing care. There, we're paying the plans a lot less to do a lot less. So while overall it's going to be more expensive, it's going to be a lot more out of pocket in that you'll have to pay for the better plans. So it's very different from us paying more for them to do the same. This is the plans actually delivering much less care and people deciding what kind of plans they want based on their ability to pay, what kind of health care they want. So it's much even worse than the current private health plans that we have right now. So it is much scarier than even that.
Thank you so much. And Margaret, do you have anything to add to this?
I think, Deanne did a good job of explaining why our healthcare costs are so high. I mean, a big piece of that is the fact that we have this huge administrative cost of a third of our healthcare dollar as opposed to 3 to 5% under a traditional Medicare. Under a privatized Medicare, the administrative cost is more like 14%. I think it's actually 9% for administration and 5% for profit, or it might be flip-flop the other way. So another reason that our healthcare costs are high is that we don't negotiate for prices. There's an excellent article by Uwe Reinhardt, which is called "It's the Price is Stupid," and we don't have a system that's a single purchaser or a monopsony that's able to negotiate for fair pharmaceutical prices or fair prices for our services. And that's one advantage of a single payer program. So I guess those are my main reasons why healthcare is so expensive in this country.
So moving, I think that the, I want to share with listeners that Healthcare Now is committed to working with our allies to make sure that we're getting out fact sheets on this, and we're certainly going to be organizing a national call-in day for people to participate and be motivated to get make contact with their elected officials to voice opposition. But in addition to that, we need to hear from folks who are ready to do organizing in their community and with their networks on the ground in opposition of this, so that we can really be coordinated and working together. Something that we're looking at in the near future is that this year Medicare turns 46 years old on July 30th, and historically Healthcare Now has always used the anniversary of Medicare as an incredibly important time to organize and raise up the success of the program and talk about why Medicare is actually the solution to our healthcare crisis and not the problem. So it's a way to really challenge, with such a popular program, the opposition to expanding it and also these threats to privatizing it. So that's something we're going to be focusing on going forward, and we hope that we can count on the network of advocates on the line and around the country to help support all this work. So it does, what I'm trying to get to now is that, you know, the policy implications are really devastating of these proposals. And the solutions really are simple, raising taxes, getting corporate greed out of our healthcare system, looking to a Medicare for All system that is based on a single-payer financing to capture a lot of the savings in the program and extend healthcare to everyone. But we're really in a political moment right now. So I'm wondering, in this light, you know, we've had challenges with getting the Democrats to really hold strong. I mean, during the health debate several years ago, there was a line drawn in the sand that they wouldn't vote for a bill that didn't include a public option, and of course, we saw where that went. So I'm wondering if both of you on the line, remaining on the line, can speak to this political moment and what it means to us as advocates for Medicare for All and people who want to see our social insurance program strengthened and not weakened.
I think that this offers a real opportunity for us. One, that healthcare is still a very hot topic, so it gives us an opportunity to reach out to organizations. First of all, to educate them and to offer ourselves to talk to them about what these cuts to our public insurance programs mean and how an improved Medicare for All would solve these problems. But it also offers us an opportunity to build coalition, to reach out to the populations who are going to be affected. So reaching out to our senior citizens, to our disabled community, to our lower income community, to those people that are going to be harmed, is very important. I think in Wisconsin, they've shown a very good model of creating a safe Badger Care coalition. When I was out there, they had 120 organizations signed on to this coalition and were making themselves a part of the protests that were going on at the rally, educating people and getting their message out there that we also need to save our health care. There was one woman I met who so poignantly said that, "I don't care if you're killed by a bullet or you're killed by a policy, it's still murder." And this is how people who are seeing really their lives being threatened by the possible loss of these programs are viewing this. And this is a very important time to make the public, if we can, the media aware, and to have our message be any part of the actions that are going on to fight these austerity measures.
And unfortunately, at some point, Democrats are going to realize, I mean, for the minority advocacy community, there's a real setting of disenfranchisement and selling out, and the Democrats are not really out there to represent their best interest. So it's sort of one of these things where, you know, the fire's not in the belly unless somebody can really show that there is a real meaningful, you know, draw a line in the sand, and this could be it. If you want everyone back at the table and to be passionate, and that's where the president's leadership is going to be, it's got to be somewhere where the line is drawn so you can get back a lot of the people that were the most, ardent advocates back there. I would argue one good place is that, yes, we're going to cut money for health care, and we're going to cut it from the corporations and the health insurance industry. You know, put it up one against the other and do it that way and, you know, put a real stake in the sand, you know. But as long as we're disenfranchised, it's hard to gather the troops.
Absolutely. There's a lot of questions coming in about, you know, how do we get our message out there? I know that both of you have been advocating for single-payer and improved Medicare for All for a long time. I'm wondering if you can give any advice to people on the line for what they can do in their communities on the ground right now to be effective at messaging our work.
Well, I think that, if you take some of these, the educating about what the what are going to be the consequences of privatizing Medicare, of privatizing Medicaid that I outlined or that I've written about in my articles or testimony, and contact organizations in your community. I think it's time to just start cold calling those who are going to be affected and saying, are you aware of this and can we come and speak to you at your next meeting? And starting to hold these conversations, bringing groups together to have these conversations about how are we going to address this problem. I think that these austerity measures are, you know, we're seeing these across the board with, you know, cuts to education, cuts to our nutrition programs. And so this is a good time to reach out to those organizations as well and say, hey, we're seeing the same austerity measures applied to healthcare. How can we start coming together and organizing to have a political voice to be present in our congresspeople's offices to make it very clear that this is not acceptable? I think organizing visits to your congressmember's office, bringing people, organizing petitions to have people sign, asking your member of Congress not to to support these cuts. They really need to hear from us, as well as the White House, organizing call-ins to the White House to get the message out there as well.
And unfortunately, this time around, I found that the facts and the truth mean less to people. I mean, the other side is using pure sort of from the gut, not based in reality messaging. So I think the individual stories and making it at the person level, what does it mean to you, that's going to be much more important than any facts, figures, or numbers, because people are just so confused and overwhelmed right now. And so it's sad, you know, one from an academic background to, you know, sort of say focus less on the reality and the numbers and much more make it personalized. So, I mean, you know, the dumb messages that the other side uses, you know, they're going to take, you know, your Medicare way to support tax cuts for the rich or something like that. Those are the kind of things that for a lot of people, that's what's going to get them motivated, because that seems to be the only thing that's working right now.
I have a question specifically for Margaret on the, but Alvin, please weigh in. Apparently there's a new initiative in the Progressive Caucus to talk about the people's budget. And there's questions about how their proposal is dealing with Medicare and Medicaid. Have you seen this effort? Do you have any comments on that, the people's budget proposal?
No, I apologize. I haven't seen the people's budget. I'll have to find out more about that.
It seems like things are moving pretty quickly, and I imagine we'll be seeing more, especially as President Obama will be making comments this Wednesday. So we'll definitely do our best for people who've written in and asked about that to take a look and see where it's at to comment. So with that, we have a few minutes left for the call. And for everyone on the line, I want folks to know that that Healthcare Now remains committed with our allies to getting timely information about what's going on and resources for you to advocate locally. And so the importance of supporting groups, of course, like Healthcare Now, Physicians for a National Health Program, the California Nurses Association, and National Nurses United is imperative as we work to build this independent movement to call for real healthcare for people. And so with that, we do have a few minutes left of the call, and I'd like to leave it open for closing remarks from Dr. Flowers and Dr. Cardoskill.
You want to go first, Goldine?
Oh, yeah, go ahead, Margaret. Yeah, no, go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
As I said, I think that this is truly an opportunity for us to step forward, and because we do have the solution. We have the solution to our healthcare crisis, but we also have the solution to our economic crisis. And what I'm excited about is the fact that, you know, as Deanne said, we need to be getting out there and in the streets with direct action to put a halt to this, and that's happening across the country. We're already seeing people that are occupying capitals and holding rallies. And so let's get healthcare out there as part of those events and be visible and reach out to them and educate them and join with them in the struggle against these austerity measures. And so I think that both, you know, it's timely in the media, so reach out to your local media to get letters to the editor, op-eds, to have rallies and let them know that you're holding these rallies if you can have actions at, you know, at clinics. There's a lot that we can be doing right now to get the message out, and I completely agree with Oldeen that making this, showing the human cost of these austerity measures, which are completely unnecessary, is going to be so important in reaching out and moving people to become involved in this what's going on.
And just, I mean, clearly they swung the pendulum too far. They do this every time that they come in. They get emboldened, and they swing it too far, and it creates a massive reaction. I'm not sure now's the time to be compromising towards the right. I think we need to hold our feet in the ground and come in from the left again and reopen that debate. Because we keep compromising, it's all going to be on their terms. And so now that they've shown America what it's all about, I think we do have an opportunity. We should start thinking about this whole concept of continuing to compromise on everything, because I think people's eyes are opening up.
Right, absolutely. And we have... people across the country are organizing around single payer and Medicare for all, and this is a time where we can continue to raise this message and the importance of pointing to Medicare as the solution and not the problem. And I just want to thank both Dr. Flowers and Dr. Cadesquio, and of course, Deanne McEwen with the California Nurses Association. She had to leave the call a little early. Like I said, we continue to be committed. Everybody on the line should be connected to healthcare now. You can sign up for free for our emails to inform you on what's going on, as well as action alerts. And you can also join healthcare now. Our membership is open to anyone. We have no financial barriers to membership if you can't commit funds, because many of our supporters across the country are also being hit by the healthcare crisis in terms of their own family budgets and personal budgets. So we recognize that, but we want to make sure that we're able to build this network to get information to you in a timely way so that you can advocate on the ground where you're at for these solutions. And we believe the bottom-up advocacy efforts and the organizing efforts, and potentially, as folks know, even the more direct action-related and civil disobedience efforts that may be necessary as we go forward, we need to be in communication with each other so that we can build this movement, so that the elected officials, Democrat, Republican, whatever they may be, really feel the pressure from us. And we know that there are many allies around the country who are going to be organizing against these cuts as well, and these terrible ideas to privatize Medicare, to raise eligibility age, to take Medicaid and turn it into a block grant program. And we're committed to making sure that folks are engaged in this and joining the fight to not just defend the programs that we have, but also to fight for an expansion and to meet real rights around the right to health and health care and so many of the other struggles that we're involved in. So I just want to thank everyone for joining in the call. For those who didn't have an opportunity to have their questions specifically answered, the Healthcare Now staff is going to be following up with all of you, and we hope we can count on your support and your energy in this fight as we go forward. So thank you again, Dr. Flowers and Dr. Cadesquio. It really was an excellent dialogue tonight, and we really appreciate your participation.
Thank you for organizing this.
Thank you.
All right, take care.
Thanks a lot.
Good night. Thanks. Bye.
And good night to everyone on the call, and we'll be in touch.